All right, thank you. Okay, so these are the topics I will be focusing on. And the people who are doing this work with me are Jia Jia Cheng and Chris Hamner, my grad students, and also Mark Hofer, who is an applied mathematician from North Carolina State University and an expert in dispersive fluid flow. And we are also very happy to have Dirte Blume and Chuan-Wai Zheng at WSU, who are experts in few body physics and optical lattices. We acknowledge funding from NSF and ARO. So here's a short outline of my talk. I will first begin with a brief introduction to nonlinear quantum hydrodynamics, but I will be very brief here because I'm sure that probably everybody of you is familiar with at least the general ideas behind it. After that, I will talk a little bit about hydrodynamics in single component systems. And as it turns out, even single component systems can already display a lot of interesting dynamics. But this discussion will mostly be used to lay the ground for the discussion of two-component or binary BECs, which will be the main part of my talk. And here I will be showing you a novel counterflow-induced modulation and instability, how we can harness it to create dark bright solitons, either individual dark bright solitons or complete dark bright solitons, as here with something like over 10 dark bright solitons. And I will also show you some about novel types of solitons that we can observe. So with this, let me begin with just a very brief introduction to BEC and hydrodynamics, and I will be very, very short here, since this is just a little bit of theory from an experimentalist perspective, so I'll just skip through it for you. The peculiar flow of superfluids is a very colorful topic that can teach us a lot about quantum matter. And BECs provide quite a novel and unique tool with which we can push these studies into new regimes. There are a number of very spectacular results in this field. For example, the generation of very large vortex lattices over here, where you can have over 300 vortices in a single BEC. Or experiments over here where we messed up the vortex lattice and obtained essentially a melted vortex lattice, just a soup of vortices drifting around here. This is an example for just giant vortex arrays. Over here we have got vortex dipoles. These are images from Brian Anderson groups, and similar results have also been obtained by David Hall, where they create two vortices and observe their evolution and trap. There's the whole field of solitons. Here an image from Randy Judith's groups at Weiss. Dispersive shock waves, or as examples from my group, Faraday waves, dark bright solitons, modulation and instability, and so on. There's a whole variety of experiments, and there are even more omissions on this slide, and I apologize for any omissions that I had to make here. For sure, many groups have obtained fantastic results with vortices and with solitons. Oftentimes, the underlying concepts that we study with BECs are very general and can be applied to a large variety of other nonlinear systems as well. For example, this is an image of a giant vortex in superfluid helium. Or think of soliton waves. They exist in water, but they are also of technological importance in optical fibers. Vortices exist, for example, in optical systems. This is a vortex in the output of a vertical cavity surface-emitting laser. Yeah?
What is the imaging?
Oh, sorry. This is kind of like an interferometric image of the depth of the giant vortex. Oh, so all this here is the helium, and there's the suppression of the density in the center. And you just see these swings because it's an interferometric measure. There are shocks in plasmas, and there are also strong connections to condensed matter like soliton and magnets or magnetic flux lattices. Oftentimes, the Gross-Pitayevsky equation is doing a great job at describing this dynamics. It also shows us where the nonlinearities come from, namely from the interaction of the atoms. And in fact, this term here, the psi squared times psi, looks very much like a curtype nonlinearity in optics. And so it is not surprising that there are strong analogies between the flow of quantum matter and the way in which light can actually flow through nonlinear media. And indeed, there's this whole subject of optical hydrodynamics, which is emphasized, for example, by Jason Fleischer's group in Princeton, who have observed shock waves in light, similar to the shock waves that we see in BECs. They also have got their versions of optical lattices, the nonlinear photonic lattices, and using light propagating through waveguides, they're also interested in doing some condensed matter analogs. Alternatively, one can also emphasize a hydrodynamic point of view by introducing density as the wave function squared and velocity as the gradient of the wave function. And this viewpoint is typically very nice to emphasize hydrodynamic effects, shock waves, dispersive effects, and so on. So if we write down these hydrodynamic equations, they look like this here. We can then compare them to the equations of classical hydrodynamics, which is the Navier-Stokes equation over here. And overall, things look very similar. So we've got a mass times acceleration term over here. There's some pressure term over here, some mean field pressure, external potential. In the classical case, we've also got an extra term over here, which, however, disappears for an irrotational fluid. And indeed, the quantum fluid is typically irrotational because it's given by the gradient of a phase. So interesting things happen when you make an irrotational system rotate. And this interesting thing is usually the formation of vortices over here. And this has been studied very well. There are more differences if we look over here at the final terms over here. In the classical system, you often have got some viscosity given by eta times Laplace of the velocity. Whereas in the quantum system, you end up with a third order derivative over here. And while at first sight this may just seem like a little technical detail, it indeed has got very interesting consequences. So the dynamics that you would expect is oftentimes dispersive, where dispersive effects dominate over the dissipative ones on here. This has important consequences when gradients get very steep, for example, for quantum shocks. Quantum shocks in dispersive systems have got a very interesting structure as a modulated wave time. They are just not a jump in the material properties as you would have it in the classical system. So with this, let me just briefly show you some of the effects in single component condensates as a discussion that will lay the ground then for the binary condensates. And oftentimes, you can find very interesting dynamics already in very simple and straightforward settings. For example, just merging two condensates or whole closing experiments. You can see a lot of dynamics with relatively simple, in relatively simple settings. Imagine, for example, that you have a classical fluid shown over here. And the density is locally suppressed by an obstacle that you push into the fluid. This is why the density is going down here to zero. Then you suddenly remove the obstacle and observe the subsequent dynamics. This is the classical dam breaking problem. So what's going to happen is that the fluid is going to rush inwards, and this is a rarefaction wave. Then when the two fluids meet in the center, they form a high density peak, and the edges of this high density peak spread outwards. And where the inwards rushing fluid meets the stationary fluid in the center, a shock wave is formed. You can repeat the experiment with quantum matter. And here the effects are somewhat different. So initially you again get a rarefaction wave rushing inwards, but then you see a lot of dispersive effects, first building up here and then this whole chain over here. So dispersive versus dissipative effects. And I will come back and talk a little bit about the nature of these in just a second. So indeed, we can do these experiments. We can take a Bose-Einstein condensate, and we can split it into two parts by using a repulsive barrier, just a repulsive laser beam. Then we can turn off this barrier and observe the dynamics as the two components of the condensate rush inwards and fill the gap. In this example, we intentionally used a very small condensate, which had just about 20,000 atoms. This is numerics, and this is the experiment. So what you can see is that indeed, after a while, you get a fairly regular chain of dark notches in the condensate. They are also reproduced in the numerics over here. And it turns out that these notches are actually a dark soliton chain. You can take this from the numerics as well as from the lifetime of these things here. So by just having a gap and closing it, letting it close in a condensate, you get a dark soliton chain. Now this is very reminiscent, maybe, of experiments that you have all seen where two condensates are released from a trap and then expand into each other and form an interference pattern. These are the experiments. This is a result from the original Kettler paper, and you can see this very nice trigonometric interference patterns over here. In our case, however, we have got a dark soliton chain down here. So quite naturally, the question arises if these two things are something very different or if they are closely related. And it turns out the key ingredient here is the difference in the interactions. when you've got two condensates and you let them expand out of the cloud, the interactions go down fairly quickly. And ideally, when they are overlapping and running into each other, they are essentially non-interacting. In our case, the merging of two condensates occurs inside the trap, so the interactions are always important.
In classical hydrodynamics, there is also a well-known example when a step, like decay of the step, leads to oscillations.
Mm-hmm.
It's called, it's one of these Gurevich-Pitayevsky problem. The issue that if you relax the step, you also get oscillation. It, of course, depends on which type of hydrodynamics you're using.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in many cases, it's fairly generic.
Is that for the shallow water waves, or?
Actually, I don't know about the application. I think mathematically, it was Carpe-Degree's equation.
Mm-hmm.
Shows
the
fact that this is shallow.
Okay. Oh, KdV equation.
Hmm?
KdV, Carpe-Degree's. Oh, yeah, KdV. Okay, yeah.
So this is shallow.
Shallow water waves,
shallow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is.
So I presume something classical system, what you showed then, is also not generic, right? You could somehow start another, take another limit of classical fluid and see the same ripples appearing.
You could do dispersive regularization instead of dissipative one for the shallow water waves. Yeah? All right. So the question is then, are these two here closely related, or are they something very different? And if I go back to the numerics that we already had on the previous slide, you can actually see that it's essentially one and the same. So here's again the numerics with the initial gap, and this is just a cross-section. When the two clouds first overlap, they indeed form a trigonometric interference pattern where the densities are still low. And then as the clouds continue to penetrate into each other, this interference pattern transforms itself into a train of dark solitons. And so here we have got a hydrodynamic perspective of matter wave interference, if you like. Mathematically, one can express this in an elliptical function solution of the nonlinear Schrodinger equation, which has got a parameter, the elliptic parameter, which for zero gives you trigonometric interference pattern. And when it turns to one, you get the soliton trains. This is a hydrodynamic perspective that we published over here. We have also repeated this experiment for higher atom numbers where interactions become more important, and then at some points excitations in the transverse direction. Again, you can just let the hole fill up and you get this density peak in the center. You again get a lot of solitons in the cloud. One can analyze these pictures and see a lot of dynamics. There are quantum shocks where the densities are very steep here, and if one looks closely, one can see like dispersive ripples being shed by the shock front over here. The numerics indicate solitons being formed. The solitons undergo snare instability, and then vortex rings are formed, and they.
So the difference between the last column and the middle is
what? These are just zoomed in images over here. Like if you look at this point between here and here, you would see that there are these solitons forming in the moment, and then this central density peak shows up. So this is just a snapshot taken in between here, and then zoom.
The time in between, but the scale is different, or
yeah, scale is
much
blown
up.
Mm-hmm. Right. This is just from plus minus 5 microns. So it's just very very much the center part. Oh, if you've got a soliton, which is over here, and if the cloud is fairly wide, the soliton can actually start snaking like this here. It can start curling up. And then as it continues to do so, the result is that you get the vortex ring out of it. It's a transverse instability of the soliton, which occurs in this case, but which we were able to avoid previously because the atom number was very low there. One can also observe this dynamics in very different settings. Just very briefly, one can, for example, take a condensate and turn on a repulsive laser beam in the center of the cloud. It's a very simple setting. If the laser beam is very weak, you just get two pulses, two density pulses, which spread out with the speed of sound. You can see them spreading out from here, this side and on this side. If you take a slightly stronger barrier, these peaks are actually running faster. And at some points, the waves breaks, and you get a lot of dispersive effects again. So one can see this dynamic in very different settings. We have also repeated this experiment with a degenerate Fermi gas. This is a single component cloud, so the atoms are non-interacting. we can again start with a Fermi cloud that looks like this. We pulse on our laser beam, and we observe what happens. So here we pulsed on the laser beam, and
so how many transverse channels do you have? Or it's like really three-dimensional?
For the BECs?
No, in this.
Oh, this is very many, many, many. So this is very far away from
100,000.
I'd have to look it up for this one, but it's at least tens to hundred. Mm-hmm. But I would have to look it up for what we used here. But this is definitely not in 1D, not quasi 1D.
How many atoms?
About 300,000. So we pulse on the laser beam. Here's the gap that opens, and you can see maybe little packets of atoms spreading out. At some point, you know, you can see the atoms coming out here. Those are the ones that we moved with the laser beam. At some point, they actually leave the cloud over here. Then they reach an outer turning point in the harmonic trap over here. And then they start falling backwards into the center of the cloud. So the outer turning point was at 10.24 milliseconds over here. So then the question is, what happens when these two packets of atoms collide?
Sorry, once more. So the imaging you do is this dispersive contrast?
No, this is repeated experiments.
Oh, repeated. So this is the open and uniform exposure.
Mm-hmm. Okay. This is all expansion images. And so this is shortly before the collision point. So we've got these two clouds of atoms rushing towards the center where they collide. And one might expect maybe there's a bump forming or something similar to what we've seen in the previous slides. But
understand, if I look at the center of mass momentum relative to K Fermi when they collide, what is it? Because maybe they're so well separated in momentum space and then
they
don't see each
through,
other.
But apparently they don't.
We can talk about that. I'll have to look up the precise numbers, but it's
this non-interacting from
non-interacting, yeah.
Polarized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Again, I can just solve it exactly, right?
Right. And as you will see in a second, the result is actually very simple. So here we are at the collision point. So what you can see, just the hole opens up again. So instead of like a density bulge, we just get a hole opening. And then the hole closes again and opens and closes and opens and closes and opens. So we have seen this over many, many cycles. So here's an image after 83 milliseconds, the hole opens up again. And we think one can just understand it from the fact that we indeed, as you mentioned, have non-interacting atoms. So they all occupy a harmonic oscillator level. So you would, to some extent, expect to see a periodicity with the harmonic oscillator frequency. And this is essentially what we see. So we just get mirror images of what we had before. We can also do this, you know, in slight variations where we pulse on the laser beam on the side, and then the hole opens up half a cycle later on the other side, and then comes back to this side, and so on. Anyways, there are predictions for observing quantum shocks in degenerate Fermi gases. For example, down here by Bogdan Damsky, and over here by Paul Wigman. But so far, we are still looking for them in the experiments. With this, I would like to leave the single component clouds and discuss the dynamics of counterflowing binary BECs, which turns out to be exceptionally rich. And in these binary systems, we have got a new degree of freedom, which is the counterflow between the two components. And we can exploit this this new degree of freedom to see a lot of dynamics. For example, a modulational instability in a miscible BEC. It's important to point out that our system that we are going to use is miscible. If you've got an immiscible system, then counterflow modulation instability would be somewhat expected. It ought to be expected for a single component cloud with their attractive interactions. But in our case, we've got a miscible system, and here the modulation instability is somewhat novel. And the key is that it's actually induced by the counterflow. And I will show you how we can exploit it to see dark bright soliton trains and novel oscillating solitons, for example, dark solitons that we are currently still investigating. So in these experiments, we start with the BEC in one hyperfine state. This is the hyperfine splitting of rubidium-87 that we use. We can, for example, start with the BEC in this state over here. And then we apply a microwave pulse to transfer a variable amount of atoms from the upper state into a lower state, for example, the one one over here. And in this case, we get a perfectly overlapped mixture. These two states that we use, they shift differently in a magnetic field. So one gets pushed up and the other one gets pushed down. So when we apply a magnetic gradient, there's a force on the atom, and that force actually pushes the atoms into opposite directions. Alternatively, we can characterize this as a differential trap shift for the two species. And oftentimes we use the 2 minus 2 and the 1 minus, the 2 2 and the 1 1. We have also used the 2 minus 2 and the 1 minus 1, and it works just the same. And then we observe the dynamics during the mixing, during the demixing of these clouds. The experimental setting is somewhat similar to the one which David Well talked about when he reported on results from the Kettler group, where they used spin gradient demagnetization cooling. But while they focused more on the temperature aspect, we focused on the dynamics, on the counterflow.
Is there a lattice on, or there is no lattice?
There is no lattice. This doesn't require any lattice. This is just a condensate in a harmonic trap. Yeah, so I should point out that in their experiments, they did have a lattice that they either ramped on first or ramped on later. So in our case, we do the counterflow, but we have no need for a lattice to see the instability in here. The system that we use is actually miscible. So when we have the two components and we just let them sit in the trap for a long time, they just don't separate. This is shown over here. So in the following, I will show you a couple of these images where the upper cloud is atoms in the 2-2 state and the lower cloud is atoms in the 1-1 state. And those images are taken after 7 and 8 milliseconds of expansion. The clouds are separated just for the imaging. While the dynamic is going on, these clouds are actually sitting overlapped in the trap. And you can see that over something like 9 seconds, the clouds just don't separate. The mixture is pretty much miscible. But if you just apply a slight gradient, you can change the dynamics. For example, here we applied a gradient that leads to essentially to a trap shift of about 60 microns difference between the two components. For reference, from here to here, it's about 500 microns. So it's just a small trap shift relative to the extent of the cloud. But you can see that this trap shift can lead to an almost complete separation of the two components because you play with the energetics of the system. So in the following, we are going to look at the dynamics during the evolution from somewhere here to somewhere there. The main effect that is dominating the dynamics is the counterflow-induced modulational instability. So imagine you start with the components that I've shown you before. You apply a weak gradient, and then you just observe what happens. For a long time, like up to 70 milliseconds, there's just a smooth counterflow going on. And then all of a sudden, the modulation instability sets in. And you can see how these notches are formed here. Or you get this very regular pattern here and the corresponding pattern over here. And these notches and humps, they are actually staggered such that the overall density is pretty much constant. This is shown here in the blue line. So here we've got a smooth evolution first, and then all of a sudden, the modulation instability sets in. And this modulation instability is triggered by the counterflow. Theoretically, there are several methods how you can actually get to the critical velocity for the onset of MI. MI meaning modulation instability here. So there's a critical velocity which you have to surpass, and then you can have the onset. One way of getting there is to use the Kappa-GP equations in 3D. Then you do a Bogliudov-Degen type analysis around a stationary term state, and you look at the resulting dispersion relation, and you check if there are imaginary parts occurring. And you'll find that those imaginary parts occur for very low wave vectors, and one can show the critical velocity is bounded by 0.1 and 0.16 of the in units of square root of rho 1, which would be the speed of sound in a single component. So it's fairly low velocities.
Numbers depend on the precise values of the scattering length?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How strongly miscible or immiscible you are?
We are just on the border. So the scattering lengths are A11 is about 100.6 A0. A12 is about equal to A22, it's 98.98. And then what counts is that the product of A11 times A22 be larger than A12 squared. So it's just on the border. So it's, I would say it's weakly miscible. This goes in here. And then the exact ratio depends on, the exact value depends on the ratio of the mixing. Alternatively, one can also emphasize the hydrodynamics point of view and use the equations of hydrodynamics over here. And now we can exploit the fact that the modulation and instability is a small k phenomenon, wavelength phenomenon, which means we can neglect those right-hand terms over here. Then one can just solve this equation. You can write it in matrix form and solve the equation for characteristic speeds. And again, see at which point characteristic speeds become complex. And the result is a little bit awkward. It's just given here for reference. So I can't really write down any closed form for it, but that's the basic idea. This essentially explains the uniform counterflow. Next, we can ask, what happens when you prepare the system with an initial density jump? This is motivated by the fact that for a single component attractive PEC.
That's a question.
Yeah.
So of course, like what you prepared, this counterflow is basically a spin spiral, right? So that starts to remind us of Stanford-Pern's experiments. And mm-hmm. he argued that, well, actually, if you have a spiral, then the instability is dominated by magnetic dipolar interactions because the wavelength of instability that you get turns out to be fairly short. So I can imagine that your magnetic length, so your magnetic interactions are also very tiny. So magnetic dipolar interactions can probably come in and also change something.
Mm-hmm. That could be this Einstein-Haas
effect.
Here you have this magnetic
gradient
and this dipole.
Well, it's just, well, I guess here, it's like, because if it's a spiral instability, it's a spiral, and the spiral is unstable right to breaking apart.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, if you have dipolar interaction, well, it's kind of magnetic dipolar interaction want to make a very complicated pattern by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So as a result, kind of where you get instabilities and what's the length scale may be very different. So do your predictions agree with this analysis which neglects dipolar interactions?
Yeah, pretty much so. Maybe a difference is that in Stanford-Kern's experiment, he actually makes a complete spiral. You know, he just winds up, he has got continuous, you know, a whole bunch of windings in his.
Today he didn't even have to make a spiral. Spirals accelerate instabilities, but now he just starts with uniform systems and shows dipolar interaction can make instabilities by themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we should talk about this later. This would be very interesting. So far we haven't seen any indication for that, but they may be there. It's definitely a good point that we should discuss about later. Mm-hmm. So this so far is for the uniform counterflow. And the next question then is, what happens when you start with an initial density jump in the condensate? Here are some 1D numerics. And since these are a lot of plots, I'll just walk you through it a little bit. On all these axes here, we have got the Z component of the 1D. This is the extent of the cloud. These are different time steps in the evolution. This is time equals 0, and then we let the system evolve. We've got the first component is blue. This is the density, first component here. And this is the density of the second component. So we prepare two components such that the overall density stays the same. And then in this case, we have got no relative velocity. And we just see rarefaction waves occurring here, a little bit of ripples over here. And that's the main dynamics. If now we increase the relative velocity from 0 to a little bit, so this component moves over here, this component moves over here, then you see that the dynamics is essentially the same. Again, you get a little bit of dispersive ripples over here, but that's about it. If you exceed the critical velocity by just a little bit, then you can see how at this step here, the modulation instability actually starts becoming important, and you start forming these trains here. And these trains are trains of dark, bright solitons. So you've got a dark soliton in one component, which is filled by a bright soliton in the other one. And this also coincides with the fact that you've got a small imaginary part of the critical speeds showing up here. If you go to even faster speeds, then you get the formation of the dark, bright solitons at the edges over here. But in addition, you get the onset of the counterflow-induced modulation instability in the huge background over here. So this means when we go just slightly above supercritical, we can exploit this technique to form dipole solitons and avoid the overall onset of the modulation instability that would otherwise just run over our dynamics. So let's see if this works in an experiment. Here we start with a 70-30% mixture, so 70% of atoms in the 1-1 and 30% of the atoms in the 2-2 state. And then we apply a weak gradient, and we ramp on the gradient, and we just wait for some evolution time. And the gradient that we applied here was fairly small. It's just a differential trap shift of something like 3 micron. And so the cloud is sitting there with the gradients, and the clouds are actually moving. So you can see here that there's this bump showing up on this edge of the condensate. The cloud evolves. You see this bump actually forms a bright soliton, and here's the corresponding dark soliton. We let the thing evolve more and more and more, and indeed we can get a whole train of dark bright solitons generated from the density step over here. And I've also got a little movie of that, so maybe let me just switch over. So here the counterflow is started. This is numerics now. For a long time, there's nothing. Then you can see how the trains start forming here, how the dark bright solitons are forming one after the other. And there's also a little bit of repulsive solitons interactions going on in here. So you can see how they bounce off each other a little bit. Yeah, this very much depends on if you leave the gradient on or off. If you leave the gradient on, for some reason it tends to kill the solitons. If you turn the gradient off so that you don't accelerate the clouds anymore, we can actually see oscillations of the solitons. I will show you some pictures in a second. So one can analyze these things, one can look at the soliton structure, and one indeed finds that in the dark solitons, the black lines over here, one finds the phase jumps, and in the bright solitons, it's essentially a smooth evolution. Over here, you've got the phase gradients. This is the phase gradients for the two components. The phase gradients go in opposite directions, which essentially indicates the counterflow. As I just indicated a second ago, we can also exploit this technique to make individual dark bright solitons, and this is shown here. For this, we just have to control the amount of atoms that we have initially in the second state. If we just use very few atoms, then we can start the counterflow, and over time, these atoms actually find themselves together in a dark bright soliton. So here's the bright part, here's the dark part. And if then we turn the gradient off, we can actually observe the soliton oscillate. So we can see it move from here, over here, and then back over here. And we have analyzed the oscillation frequency, and it's interesting to note that these oscillation frequencies are very, very slow. So typical trap frequency along the long axis is about 1.3 hertz. Fortunately, our dark bright solitons have got very long lifetimes, so we can observe this for about 5 seconds or longer. And typical frequencies are somewhere like 0.4 or 0.1 hertz. It very much depends on the amount of the filling that you put into the solitons. The more of the bright component you have, the slower it actually becomes. And we have also taken a very brief look at creating two solitons. So here we've got two solitons, and then we can observe them actually cross inside the trap. But these are, again, these are not phase contrast images. These are individual shots from the individual runs of the experiment. So it's a little bit difficult for us to say exactly if there's any retardation effects or anything going on with the interaction. So finally, in the last part of my talk, I just wanted to give you a few insights into novel soliton structures that we observe. And for this, let's go back to the modulation and instability, but this one we create just a very sparse pattern. The previous pattern that I've shown you has been fairly dense with the modulation instability. Here we just create a very sparse pattern, which we can get by just using a smaller trap shift. And if you do this, you can find interesting structures, like if you analyze these these structures over here, you can see there's a bright hump here adjacent to a dark notch, and the second component has got a dark notch and adjacent to a bright hump. It gets more clear when you actually draw cross sections for it, and this is the cross section. If we zoom in a little bit, you can see the structure over here, where one component has got the notch and the hump, and the other one has got the hump and the notch over here. And this is an oscillating dark soliton. It's oscillating because it shows a beating behavior. And you can see this beating behavior better if I go back to numerics and a little movie. So here we just have initially smooth counterflows being started. Then you see some effects coming in from the edges, but at some point modulation instability sets in the center. And at the very onset point, you can see those dark white solitons over here, those features. And you can see how they actually oscillated a little bit. And then since the counterflow stays on here, the system more or less becomes very chaotic. Well, not chaos in the strict sense, but so here you can see just at the onset point, if I go back a little bit, there you can see the dark white solitons oscillating in their shape. So what does this oscillation actually look like? If you assume identical scattering lengths in for all components and for the inter-components interaction, you can write solutions which look something like this. We've got a dark white soliton over here, and then it transforms itself through these stages here, and eventually you get a soliton which looks like the first one, but the role of the two components are inverted. If you use the correct scattering lengths that we have in the experiment, the dynamics still looks a little bit, looks very much the same, just the shapes are a little bit distorted. So with this, we can go back to the experiment and just take a couple of snapshots after the sparse modulation pattern and see what types of soliton sets we can find. So there are just some examples shown here of the stuff that we see. Out here, for example, this is the typical dark bright soliton, where you've got the dark soliton notch filled by a bright soliton over here. Then over here, you've got the dark soliton that oscillates. That's the guy which I showed you in the previous slide. Over here, we've got some solitons merging. You can see that the center part is actually quite big, so there's a big hole over here. In this image over here, we have got images of different phases of the oscillating dark soliton. If you look at this guy over here, it has the black line. The black component has got the hump and the notch. And then over here, the black component has got the notch and the hump. And then here it's reversed again, the hump and the notch. Down here, we've got a funny structure which looks like a triplet, where you've got a hump, a notch, a hump, and then back down again. So there's a lot of dynamics which we are still analyzing in detail. One can also observe dark solitons during the mixing of two components. So if you've got initially separated cloud and you just let them flow into each other, you again can get dark solitons. This is shown here in the cross section, the hump and the notch, and the notch and the hump. All right, so just a quick outlook. One possibility how one could actually expand these studies is by going from effectively 1D dynamics, or systems, not 1D, but our dynamics are, to three-dimensional dynamics. And very recently, there has been some suggestion by the Tsubota group who actually analyzed this and found a behavior of turbulence, quantum turbulence in these systems, where initially little disks of solitons form, then they break into vortex rings, the vortex rings interact. And there has been some analysis done on this, like the behavior of the entropy, which is integrated omega squared, has been analyzed and was shown to be somewhat similar to the decay in the classical system. But this is just as a possible idea. So in conclusion, I've shown you some experiments about single-component BECs, how we go from interference to soliton trains. I've then talked about binary BECs, counterflow-induced MI, how we can harness MI in order to create dark white solitons and see novel types of solitons over here. We've got also other projects going on, like phase finding of a BEC into a soliton train. This is a train of dark white solitons. And we have done some studies about disorders in Fermi systems and We are hoping to repeat those with incommensurate lettuces soon. So, and with this, I thank you for your attention. And I'm certainly open for any discussion during the week. Thank you.
Questions or comments?
My understanding is that Gross Petayevsky described the experiments pretty well. So do you see some qualitative effect which did not capture?
No, we don't see those in the experiment. So far, it looks pretty much GP. It may be that if one had better like resolution, if you could see like stuff like fillings inside of solitons or something, that then you would have a chance to see something beyond GP. But those effects would be very hard to detect for us. Like if we would look for fillings of solitons and we look in expansion, I'm not sure if we have any chance of seeing anything. But it's certainly a good point, and I would be very interested in hearing like if there are any effects beyond GP that would be easy to detect, where one could just go ahead and see, you know, this is a decisive point that separates one from the other. My impression is that so far they are kind of like very subtle.
I mean, the difference with
Stamper
Korn, as I understand, Stamper Korn prepares static spiral in the sense that at each point she has a superposition of the state, internal state.
That's the first experiment.
It's the first experiment.
And later experiments, they just cool it. It goes unstable.
And it goes unstable.
Nothing is final symbol.
It's the first evidence that there is a difference. Because here I understand he has an incoherent mixture and this movement.
Right, so there, of course, it's more complicated because they have magnetic field on and magnetic moment is precessing, so it ends up being a complicated dipolar interaction averaged over precession. In your case, maybe, again, you use two hyperfine states, so maybe depending on the magnetic field, I don't know whether they have, if the electron spin is basically the same, then maybe the magnetic dipolar interaction is strongly suppressed because both states have the same dipolar moment.
Yeah, we also have got a relatively high bias field of a Gauss on in these experiments. So as far as spin dynamics is concerned,
I just think about the electronic part of the hyperfine state. Does it differ much between the two states?
I mean,
have hyperfine spin, right? But it's a combination of nuclear and electron spin. And of course, magnetic dipolar interactions just come from electron spin.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to know whether the electron spin states differ.
We are in the stretched states, right?
I don't remember which states.
Yeah. And maybe we talk about it later.
Still described by the Gross Petayevsky, though, although with a non-loss of
complicated
non-dipolar. To go beyond Gross Petayevsky, in principle, if you have instability in the system, there is always quantum fluctuation, but to see it in such a big system is very difficult to talk to, I don't know. The same thing with 100 atoms. And,
right.
Any more comments or questions? Well, if not, let's thank Peter. Peter.